Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good morning. Today is Thursday, October 17th, 2013. This is John Friend, and you're listening to The Realist Report here on Talk Shoe. Thanks for tuning in today. My website is john-friend.net, and you can contact me via email at john.robert.friend@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook. Be sure to visit AmericanFreePress.net and subscribe to America's Last Real Newspaper if you are not already. And this week we've had another busy week here on The Realist Report. On Monday, I interviewed Eli James of Anglo-Saxon-Israel.com, and we discussed Christianity and, in particular, Christian identity. It was a very interesting conversation. And then on Tuesday, I interviewed Clement Pulaski of TrueSonsOfAbraham.com, and we discussed William Dudley Pelley, who was the leader of the Silver Legion, a sort of American fascist or American nationalist populist political party back in the 1930s and 1940s. And then just yesterday, I interviewed Sophia Smallstorm, and we discussed a variety of topics relating to some health issues, some male-female relations issues. It was a pretty interesting conversation. She's a very unique individual and has some very unique insights. So be sure to check out those programs. You can see them on the TalkShoe page, or you can also see them at my website, john-friend.net. And today, we have another great program lined up. I will be joined by my special guest, Tom, in Connecticut, in just a moment. Tom and I have been focusing on psychological operations, information warfare, media manipulation, and the systematic use of deceit to attack and distort our worldview and our very perception of reality to advance particular political agendas. And today, we will be continuing along these lines. So, Tom, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you back.
Hey, good morning. Same here.
Yeah, how's everything going? It's noon out there on the East Coast. We're just getting the day started here out in California.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's great to have you back. People really like these programs. I received some feedback from last week's show, and, people seem to really like these programs that we do. So, again, we're...
Yeah, you know why that is? That the reason is because you're actually a truth seeker, and you're not BSing them, and I think they can tell.
Right. Yeah, that's... So, we got a lot of different topics to talk about today. We're gonna address a number of different subjects. And I'm trying to think where to start. If you go over to john-friend.net, I have this program already posted, and I included some relevant links for this program. And maybe we can start out. The first link I have here is over to Dr. James Tracy's Memory Hole blog. And then I brought this up yesterday with Sophia briefly. We didn't really get into it too much, but he's posted a couple. He's really been following the Sandy Hook alleged school shooting quite closely. And if you go over to memoryholeblog.com, which you can find again at my website for this program, you can see his website, and at the very top there's a couple posts relating to Sandy Hook. And he also has a very excellent Sandy Hook massacre timeline. And it's a great resource, to really kind of figure out what really took place at Sandy Hook or what really didn't take place at Sandy Hook. The most recent articles that he posted, the first one is Sandy Hook demolition crew sworn to silence, and they're actually going to be following the Sandy Hook school, and the people that are involved in the demolition are sworn to silence. They can't talk about it. And then the second article that he put up on October 13th is entitled Sandy Hook Actors, Elite Political Connections. And he goes through and talks about how many of the people that we see in the media that allegedly lost a child at the Sandy Hook school shooting are connected to the political establishment and even the mainstream media in Hollywood. So, Tom, I don't know if you have any comments on this. I find it very interesting, to say the least. And it just amazes me. I mean, I guess one of the things that I'd like to say also about the Sandy Hook thing, when I say that it was a hoax, I guess it sort of is speculation to some degree. I guess what I'm really trying to say is that there's really no reason for us to believe that this actually took place, because there's been no legitimate proof or evidence, presented to demonstrate that this shooting even happened. So why do people assume it happened? I guess that's just sort of a question I have for people out there that still, you know, have trouble coming to grips with this reality that, you know, maybe the school shooting didn't really happen. There's no evidence or proof to show that it did. Tom, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do you have any comments on Sandy Hook? Or maybe?
Yes, I do. I do. Rather than getting mired into the content of the official story or the unfolding narrative that's being fed to you, if you're not really sure or you really want to know, you know, what happened, it would be a good idea to acquaint yourself with formal methods of countering deception and misperception in intelligence analysis, and how organizations such as the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States operates when they are dealing with intelligence and information, you know, coming into them. They do not simply turn on Fox News and have the TV tell them what to think. It does not work that way. If they don't work that way, neither should you.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah, and we've gone into detail, especially in touch. Well, we need to go into more detail. I think that these problems are going to continue to persist. When I say problems, I mean perception problems. When we're dealing, you know, with people interacting with the news media, they just, I think most people aren't familiar with the methods such as, you know, the analysis of competing hypotheses that, you know, is that we've touched on. And there's been some developments and morphs to the ACH process, including one called the analysis of competing hypotheses using subjective logic, which is really a way of refining that methodology further. But instead of listening to what the media is presenting to you, or also even instead of just reading the Memory Hole blog, what you really need to do if you want to know what happened or what didn't happen is you need to start constructing your own matrix and plug in information that's available to you.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to quickly figure out where the facts are and where the complete lies are. You'll be able to easily separate those out. And then your job is going to be to investigate the facts further, and you'll know where to spend your time. And I'll tell you, it's not on TV, and it's not really reading prose either. You know, the human brain is not optimized for taking in complex information in the format of prose. We're primarily visual, and you need to, this is why I keep pointing people back to the ACH, because it's primarily a visual method of seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're making some good points. And I mean, yeah, there are ways to professionally evaluate information. And, you know, as we've outlined in past shows, that, you know, this is what intelligence agencies do.
We need to go into detail. I think these latest developments and lies have basically triggered in me a need to, you know, actually, I'm going to go and full on do this and show you how I know what I know. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting because a lot of people that criticize those of us who would question Sandy Hook and question if a shooting did in fact take place and question if all these children really did get killed, they are not using structured methods to evaluate their information.
They're using intuition.
Well, yeah, they're appealing to authority and they're appealing to our emotions. They're using generalities. They're distorting our views and our statements and what we're actually saying. And this is a huge one. They always say somehow, oh, well, you're going to discredit us for, you know, if you say that this was fake, or, you know, maybe these children didn't die, or maybe no planes actually did hit the World Trade Center towers and you know, 9/11, there's a lot of fake aspects of 9/11. You're going to discredit our movement for bringing up these subjects. And these are all fallacious arguments.
Yes. They're classic. Silly. They're classic, you know, basically we call that intellectual dishonesty.
It is intellectual dishonesty. Mm-hmm. It's not dealing with what we're actually saying, what we're actually presenting. That's absolutely right. And I see it over and over and over again. Oh, you're going to discredit the movement if you bring this up. What do you mean? How am I discrediting anything? Look at what I'm saying. You know what I mean? It's just a way to avoid actually addressing the information I'm presenting.
Yeah, your target audience are not those people. What you're receiving flack, okay, from two basic groups. One is operatives who are paid to attack you, and the other is just stupid people. Okay, that is not your target audience here with your program. Neither of those.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This Sandy Hook thing is. I mean, I just don't know how anybody could accept what the government and media are telling us about this event. There's no proof. There's absolutely no proof this shooting took place. All of the information that we've received points to the conclusion that this did not happen, at least certainly not the way that the government and media have presented. And there's simply no reason to actually believe that this event took place. And it seems clear to me that these shootings, these public shootings or mass shootings or whatever, it seems clear to me that they're really designed to psychologically entice Americans to reject their Second Amendment rights and their traditional American identity. I mean, gun ownership is very strongly associated with traditional American identity. And you'll notice, and we talked about this last time, the use of guilt. These evil gun owners are at fault for all these school shootings because they won't give up their guns. The use of guilt is key in these, and especially relating to these school shootings, I would think. Have you noticed
that?
Yeah,
they're using guilt. Oh, absolutely. They're using the guilt tactic because it seems to work well on white people who tend to be vulnerable to the use of that tactic. There are other ethnic groups that does not work on very well. And in fact, when you try to guilt them, it rolls off the back.
Ooh, Tom, we're getting a little bit of – your voice is getting a little bit distorted here.
Okay, well, I'll slow down. I can't – I'm close to – the computer and I don't know when the earlier connection was a little bit messed up also.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's, I guess it's just something we're going to have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, guys, I may actually be switching back over to Blog Talk Radio. I'm not sure yet. I'd really like to be able to produce these radio programs all on my own and set up my own system here. I tried downloading some software just the other night and I use a MacBook and they didn't have a program for Mac, and the one that they were recommending was like, I think it was $80 or $90, and I wasn't too familiar with it, so I didn't end up purchasing it. So I'd like to be able to do these all on my own, but I don't know if that's going to be possible. So I may end up just switching back to Blog Talk Radio, and hopefully we'll have some more luck with that. And it also offers a lot more features. I can play audio clips and music and whatnot. So stay tuned for that. I may end up going back over there. Just wanted to let everybody know that before I forget. I just actually made a YouTube video. A listener of the Realist Report, Matthew, who I've talked to a couple times on the phone now, really cool guy, he sent me a book called The Bee Thing, which was made by this art group called Gelatin. And this Gelatin art group is they were based in Austria, and they were living – well, see, this is the thing. I actually got a comment on my website. The title, if you go over to john-friend.net and look on this radio program, this post for this radio program, you'll see the second link is entitled The Mysterious Gelatin Art Group Living in WTC World Trade Center Prior to 9/11. And I posted this on my website last night. I made the YouTube video yesterday afternoon. And there's a description right there, and the YouTube video is embedded in the website. And then I have a couple links below that. And I go through and I talk about the Israeli military and intelligence operatives posing as art students who are engaging in a massive espionage operation all across the United States prior to and even after 9/11. And I get into the Dancing Israelis, the only people that were actually arrested on 9/11 in New York City, you know, connected to what was going on. And then I also talk about this Gelatin art group who was living. I've seen reports that they were actually living in the World Trade Center Tower, Tower 1. Somebody left a comment on this post here saying that they were just working there. They weren't actually living in the towers. And I went back and I looked at the book, the Gelatin Beething book, and it doesn't say if they were actually living there. It says specifically in the book that they were renting space through the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. And so it's a little bit unclear to me if they were actually living there or if they weren't. So maybe I need to go back and edit this and update the title of it. But they certainly were in the World Trade Center Tower, and they performed this very bizarre art stunt where they built a balcony off of the 91st floor of World Trade Center Tower 1. And this Lower Manhattan Cultural Council allegedly had connections to the other Israeli art students who were, you know, that was their cover. They were actually, in fact, military and intelligence operatives working for the State of Israel, but they were just posing as art students. And there's reports that these people living in the World Trade Center Tower were connected to them. And so I go through and I show everybody the book. I've heard about this book on the internet and I've seen photos of it, but I've never seen anybody actually go through and actually show everybody what's in the book. And it's really, really bizarre. So watch the video and check it out. I go through each page and show you the photos and what they were doing and what they were all about. So, Tom, we've talked about this privately. I don't think there's any doubt that these people had something to do with what took place on 9/11.
Well, I mean, do you believe in coincidences, and how many do you believe in when they're sequential? I mean, which floor did they did this group rent space on allegedly? And where did one of the airplanes allegedly strike the building?
Exactly. Yeah, and I bring them in the video. They were on the 91st floor, and apparently, according to the Beething book, there were other artists living on this floor as well.
Well, that must just be a random coincidence, right?
Yeah. And according to the official story, Flight 11, American Airlines Flight 11, smashed in to World Trade Center Tower 1 between the 92nd and 98th floor. So just above where these people were. And
wow.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. Coincidence, huh?
And it has to be. It has to be, because to think otherwise might assault my worldview.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's really weird, and I have a link over to – apparently this Gelatin group, they changed the spelling of their name. In the Beething, they spell it G-E-L-A-T-I-N, and then now if you go to the official page, it's G-E-L-I-T-I-N. So
right.
The A and the I, I'm not sure why. But it's a really, really weird art group. I mean, if you go to their site, there's some really just – I mean, you know, Hitler talks about the Bolshevation of you know, the culture. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Basically, you know, these degenerate, totally perverted Jews essentially taking over the culture and totally corrupting art. And if you look at the Gelatin page, you'll see exactly what he's talking about. I think he actually specifically says deranged and degenerate minds have taken over essentially our art and our culture and – That's what these people are. They have very, very just weird, very weird artwork. I don't even consider it art. So anyways, be forewarned, if you actually go to that website, you'll see some very weird stuff. And then in this blog post that I put up here, I also have a photo, which somebody left a really interesting comment I'd like to read. And in this photo, if you just go and click on this blog post and look at it, it's the two twin towers. And this photo was taken in the morning, apparently. And you can actually see through World Trade Center towers. And let me just read this comment real quick, Tom, and then you can comment on this. Some anonymous commenter on my website posted this just this morning. And he or she is specifically talking about this photo. He says, "This picture is shown in a video about the Gelatin group available on YouTube. In that video, I think the claim is made that it is taken around 1978. As a resident of New York City during the 1970s, I can state unequivocally that this picture was taken considerably earlier than that, most likely in the time period of 1971 to 1974. The simple reason for this is that it shows a construction crane still present at the top of the South Tower, while the external construction of both towers appear to have been completed. This was the case during the above time period. So he's saying that this photo was actually taken in the early 1970s when the towers were being constructed. And then he goes on to say, I lived in Queens at the time and had a view from my bedroom windows of virtually the entire Manhattan skyline, from the downtown Wall Street area all the way north to beyond the Central Park area. I was able to see clearly the Twin Towers at any time of day or night. All I had to do was look out my window, which I obviously frequently did. I distinctly remember seeing the crane atop the South Tower for a considerable time after the external construction of the towers appeared to be complete, perhaps for as long as 2 years. Eventually, one day, perhaps around 1974 or thereabouts, the crane was gone. Anyone who lived in New York City at the time can confirm my observation if they happen to remember. I was a young teenager at the time, so I was somewhat fascinated by the towers, hence my clear memory. To further elaborate on this picture, since the North Tower is the one on the left and the South Tower is on the right, it indicates this picture was taken from the west, looking east, so that would explain, it was a sunrise and you can see the sun in the back. That would explain, the sun coming through and shining through the towers. looking east, probably from an airplane or helicopter flying over the Hudson River. The time of day would have been during the morning sunrise. The empty floors, except for the central cores containing the elevator shafts, and the two sections housing mechanical rooms in both towers, one-third and two-third of the way up on both towers, is further proof that this picture was taken during the final phases of interior construction during the above time frame, because it shows that few, if any, tenants had moved into the buildings as of that time. And then he says, I'm aware of the evidence that indicates that few tenants ever used the buildings, but that is beside the point I'm making. For the record, I am a 9/11 truther, and I'm not posting this to criticize those who seek to find the truth in regard to the criminal acts of 9/11. I'm simply pointing out that, from what I know, this picture does not show anything unusual or sinister in regard to the towers or the events of 9/11. And that's a good point, and I actually say that up here at the top. There has been speculation and some evidence presented that perhaps many of for instance maybe the towers were never actually completed and built how most people think they were built. And there's also been speculation that many of the people who were allegedly tenants in the World Trade Center towers were never really there, and there weren't really very many people occupying or using the World Trade Center towers. So I don't know. It's still a mystery to me. I mean, this stuff is just so bizarre and it just fascinates me. That's why I wanted to do this video and show everybody what this book was all about and talk a little bit about this gelatin art group. So Tom, what do you make of this? This is just, very interesting to me.
Yeah, it's hard to figure out where to put that into the mosaic, you know, of facts and lies here, which brings me back to this whole idea and of using structured methods to determine truth. Okay. And that's really what we're going to have to do. I think if these problems are going to persist until we finally put it to bed. And the way to do that is to use structured methods, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we need to actually show people how this is done. A lot of this is visual. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to, really get it. If I was going to write a map of the United States or create a map of the United States with all the various roads, I wouldn't do it in prose, would I? Do you realize how long the book would be?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is kind of like I'm trying to get people to understand that there are structured methods of dealing with these complex pieces of the puzzle to figure out what really did happen or what is true versus what isn't true using the powerful visual formats, mm-hmm. kind of like a map.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we've talked about in the past as well, how you literally have to, kind of lay this all out in a visual format in order to properly do, an evaluation of the evidence and to,
you do, your brain is optimized for vision. It's not exactly.
Yeah.
You can't see, if you're reading, okay, I'm reading through, a book and on page 4, it says something, and on page 2000, it says something that might refute a little bit of what page 4 says. That's going to be a lot that's going to be kind of difficult for me to make those connections. Whereas if I saw it on a whiteboard, I could just draw a line between the two, right?
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I posted a video on my Facebook page the other day, and it was a video. I'm going to try to pull it up right now. My internet is really for some reason my browser won't let me use. You know, I can't, when I pull up a new tab, it's just like I can't pull up a new tab, so I have to open up a brand new page. I don't know. Never mind. I'm sorry. My internet browser is just acting a little bit weird right now. But anyways, I posted a video on my Facebook page. It was on YouTube, and it was this very it was a sob story about people who allegedly jumped from the World Trade Center towers on 9/11. And I don't think that I don't think we can take these videos at face value that people really did jump from the World Trade Center towers. Okay. I don't think that if you actually look into this stuff, you'll see that there's all sorts of problems with these videos. And I posted this, I left a comment on this YouTube video, and the YouTube video is entitled 9/11 Jumpers, True Stories, exclamation point, you know, like five or six exclamation points. And it was this very emotional, touching story of allegedly a couple who was in the World Trade Center towers, and they jumped holding hands off the, you know, to escape the fires. They jumped off the buildings. And I mean, I just don't buy this. This is just absolutely ridiculous to me. So I left a comment, and I said, you know, I posted it on YouTube, and I didn't think that the person's channel, I didn't think that they would actually approve my comment. So I copied it, and I do this quite a bit. I'll copy the comment, and then I'll post it on my Facebook page with a link to the article or video I'm commenting on, just so that way I have it there and, you know, people can see it or whatever. And I got a lot of comments on this, and, you know, people were saying and it kind of just shows you, like what we were talking about earlier, you know, people using just, you know, appealing to authority, appealing to emotions, just – excuse me, distorting what I was actually saying or some of the statements I've made or some of my views on media deception and psychological operations and whatnot, and just saying, oh, you're going to discredit us by talking about this, blah, blah, blah. It's all basically fallacious arguments. And it turns out Mike Delaney and I might have a little debate on the whole no planes and other psychological aspects of 9/11 in the future. So I want to let everybody know that. Hopefully that'll take place. I actually sent him a message just on Skype here earlier, or actually last night before I went to bed, saying that next Monday would probably be the best day for me. So, him and I have kind of disagreed on this subject. I've heard him talk about it on his radio programs, and I think he's totally wrong about this. And I don't think from what I've heard anyways, I don't think he really understands what some of the points that we're making about the planes and the videos and whatnot. So hopefully we'll have a nice civilized discussion on this. And, you know, I don't know if we might end up having just to agree to disagree, but yeah, I just want to let everybody know that we'll hopefully be having a discussion on this in the next week or so.
You just said a couple of magic words. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Disagreement and agreement to disagree.
Yeah.
All right, and that's what I'm prepared to talk about today.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, that was my lead.
Mm-hmm.
That was my lead-in for what we're going to talk about. Yeah, we were going to focus on the theory of disagreement.
Exactly.
Why people,
there is one.
Yeah, why people disagree, truth-seeking, what it is and what it isn't, the role of worldview, myths, and narratives in disagreement, and how worldview, myths, and narratives are manipulated by those in power, and how to achieve attitude change.
And the attitude change is, you know, the attitude change that's being perpetrated against you
mm-hmm.
right now, and the methods that are used, and also how to use those same methods to achieve attitude change through people that you interact with to convince them of what is true. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just jump into what is your understanding of the theory of disagreement?
Well, first of all, let's define it. Disagreement is the lack of consensus or approval, right? In studying disagreement, I've found that, you'll quickly wind up looking at intellectual honesty. And it turns out that intellectual honesty is it's characterized by an unbiased, honest attitude where you don't allow your personal beliefs to interfere with your pursuit of what is true. Relevant facts and information are not purposely omitted, even when they might contradict your own hypothesis. And, you don't try to give misleading impressions to undermine your opponent or the person you're disagreeing with. You'll see a lot of that. You'll see a lot of evidence that, the evidence that John has just mentioned of people engaging in intellectual dishonesty. They may be doing it for various reasons. Maybe it's self-serving, or maybe they just don't understand much about disagreement theory. And it turns out that when you study disagreement, truth seekers accessing the same facts should not disagree.
Right. How can you disagree?
Okay, that is a,
how can
a
you
basic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, how could you disagree if we all have the same facts?
Well, you can't.
You can't. Yeah. Unless.
But you'll see
you're not being honest.
Exactly.
Or
you'll
there's
see
some
that
sort of bias or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll explain what those factors are. Two people accessing the same facts cannot disagree. You can't. If there are two apples sitting on a table, how many apples are sitting on the table? All right? I mean, come on. But you'll see in the real world, that's not the case. And it turns out that when you're dealing with human beings, where you stand on a subject often depends upon where you sit. In other words, where you stand on a subject, maybe not you, maybe you are a truth seeker, but people who aren't truth seekers, their viewpoints are malleable depending on how those facts might affect them. Okay?
Interesting,
and
yeah.
Very big problem, but you have to know that that's what you're dealing with people. And the other problem is that many people simply believe what they want to believe. All right? And, people disagree on facts. They disagree due to random belief influences. They disagree due to the beliefs that maybe they reason better than others or they think they do. They routinely disagree with others using tactics and rationality standards that discount prior facts, prior assumptions favoring the opponent. Okay, so in other words, they stack the deck against the other person. This happens a lot of times. An intellectually honest person will take special care not to employ any of those tactics. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that most disagreements about factual things are fundamentally dishonest. And, what is that? It's dishonesty is a disposition to lie, cheat, defraud, or deceive, right? That's just what it is. That kind of brings me into rationality and asking the question, are human disagreements rational? Well, the fact is you can't have your own facts. Facts are agenda blind. Okay? So really that's the thing that we need to attack. When you're dealing with somebody, let's say like Mike, and he thinks that planes were used, okay? Instead of just going around and around, in circles, we need to find out why he thinks that and what his fact base is.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Or anything, for example. So,
that's the first question I try to ask people. It's like, why do you think that planes actually did hit the World Trade Center towers? Because you saw it on TV? That's why you do that.
Right.
That's why you
they
do
saw
that.
Video, and then they don't want to talk about this any further once you investigate, what the method of collection of that data and the chain of custody. We have systems in our society to deal with these problems, fact finding, for example, and settling controversial questions. This is what courts of law are about and trials, and it's also what the scientific method is all about. It's separating truth from fiction. So, are typical, human disagreements honest? To consider that question you have to consider what that person's priors are and their rationality. Okay, their prior assumptions, their prior belief system, and how rational they are or in applying logic. And it turns out that, you know, that you'll see that many people do not apply logic in a rational fashion, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're really doing is they're protecting their position, okay? And this is, you know, regardless of facts, they're protecting their position. And when you study, again, like I said, when you study the theory of disagreement and how people interact, human beings anyway, you'll see that this is really what happens. If a person disagrees because they systematically violate the rationality standards that they say they value, okay, and they hold up for others, then their disagreements are dishonest. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, if both people aren't, if you don't apply the same standards the same way to both people, then there's a problem straight off the bat. You know, there needs to be a rule set. Rationality standards and values, determining what is a fact and what isn't a fact, those kinds of things, those kinds of rules need to be applied equally on both sides.
Yeah, and in many cases, most cases, they're not.
Well, I would say in almost all cases of disagreement, they're not. And
yeah.
I can show you why. I wrote a little story last night that seeks to describe in detail the interactions of a typical disagreement. And I use you and Mike, actually, as, you know, the sort of people that are duking it out. Real-world disagreements seem, they really, instead of being fact-based, they seem to revolve around, you know, things like relative abilities, such as who's smarter, and then emotional stuff like politics, morality, religion, and especially those kinds of things where people have a strong emotional reaction and they have difficulty looking objectively at a fact pattern, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, psychologists suggest that human disagreements typically depend heavily on each person believing that he or she is better than others at overcoming undesirable influences like cognitive biases, even though the person might not even be able to define what a cognitive bias is. It's kind of funny in a way.
Yeah. And that is so true. You know, if you disagree with somebody, and I mean, in my own personal life, it's like, oh, you know, you it's like, geez, why can't they just see this? They're so dumb. You know, it's like, you think that, you know, and you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you think you're smarter than them or something. And that's often, yeah. And that's not a good, and I mean, I don't think that's a good way to go about doing this, you know, to engage in a dialogue or discussion. But I mean, that's often what it turns into.
Most times it is. It turns out that people tend to dismiss the arguments of others, not based upon their factual content, but often on the grounds of who it is that's proposing the argument.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
And this is a human problem. This is something that we have to be aware of. They commonly use reasons like, well, they're not, the other person isn't as smart, they're not as knowledgeable, or maybe they're less able, or, you know, they sidestep the facts. People, you know, oftentimes this happens on, you know, even smart people do, even relatively high IQ people tend to do this. The reasons, I'm not sure why they are, they might even be encoded in DNA, I'm not sure. The positions taken on a lot of disagreements seem predictable depending on who the groups are. You know, as I mentioned earlier, where you stand depends on where you sit. This is a general, you know, think people that have studied disagreement theory will just point to that statement. It's something that, you know, you have to be aware of. And people do seem to be inclined to believe what they want to believe. They also seem to be very, very susceptible to suggestion and manipulation, especially through emotional means, as we discussed, things like guilt, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that, okay, you're dealing with a fundamental human issue here where people, you know, tend to take sides just because they're taking sides, I guess. It's not really rational.
So, it's not rational. It's not objective.
Right, exactly.
It's more emotion-driven or driven by self-interest.
Maybe even group psychology and, might be a thing like Kevin MacDonald could probably talk about this, maybe it's a group evolutionary strategy or something,
Yeah. Good point.
It's coded in the brain somewhere. But if you really want to know the truth, you have to understand what you're dealing with the human animal. We're not perfect.
It shows our limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think, we know enough now maybe where we can mitigate some of these issues and find and get closer to what is true versus what isn't true, right?
Yeah,
but it turns out
that's right.
This brings me more into disagreement theory where, there's this thing called Bayesian analysis. And I'm not going to go too much depth into this today, but we should cover that on another show. And it's really important. To understand what that is, it's a statistical method of it's sort of a statistical method of scientific inquiry using an iterative process. That's what Bayesian analysis is. Long story short, we use it a lot in intelligence analysis, okay, and especially with those structured methods I talked about. But Bayesian, somebody who's rational, will behave a certain way when they get into a discussion about something. You mentioned this thing, agreeing to disagree.
Yeah.
It's kind of, we found that that's really impossible.
Yeah. Well, it's just a sort of a cordial way of going our separate ways, I guess,
Exactly. That's what it is. Bayesian theory, basically what that is, I'll just describe it real quickly. Scientific hypotheses typically are expressed through probability distributions for some sort of observed data, okay, probabilities, right? The probability distributions depend on unknown quantities, usually called parameters. In the Bayesian paradigm, which is statistical, current knowledge about parameters are expressed by placing a probability distribution number on the parameters that we call prior distribution. When new data becomes available, the information they contain regarding the model parameters is expressed in terms of a likelihood, okay, which is proportional to the distribution of the observed data given the model parameters. This information is then combined with the prior to produce an updated probability distribution called the posterior distribution on which all Bayesian inference is based. Bayesian analysis was developed, back in the 1800s and has now really come into its own with the advent of modern computers that can deal with a lot of information quickly. It does work. It's very, very good. It's a good tool to help to optimize arguments and also find truth. So
interesting.
We can get into that. It's very important. It's used a lot in predicting stuff. It's just amazing. Very, very powerful tool. But I wrote this story last night, to kind of exemplify a little bit about some of the issues regarding disagreement, and I'm just calling it John and Mike, okay?
Okay.
And here we go. Imagine John hears a noise, and it's you, John. I'm just going to tell you it's you, all right? He looks out the window, and he sees a car speeding away. Mike also hears the same noise, looks out a different window, and sees the same car. Okay, in the case of a shooting or hit-and-run accident, it might be important to identify the car as accurately as possible. John and Mike's immediate impressions about the car will differ due both to differences in what they saw, the angle, for example, the lighting, and how they interpreted their sense impressions. John's first impression is that the car was an old tan Ford, and he tells Mike this. Mike's first impression is that the car was a newer brown Chevy, but he updates his belief upon hearing from John. And upon hearing Mike's opinion, John also updates his belief. So they both kind of think it's a shade of brown, but they're not really sure which model it is, kind of thing. You know, it was real quick, you know, that kind of thing, right? They then continue back and forth, trading their opinions about the likelihood of various possible car features. They might even trade evidence in support of those opinions, go online, look at car features, discuss the relative frequency of certain cars being a certain area and all that kind of stuff, right? Hey, wait a second. I saw like that car and, you know, this car that looked like this looks like Joe's car, or this guy, you know, those guys, the drug dealers have a car that looks like that. I don't know. Okay. Whatever it is that you guys are going to discuss, this is how things actually usually unfold in discussions regarding these kinds of things. If Mike sees John as an honest truth seeker who would believe the same things as Mike, given the same information, this is called, I mentioned, having common priors or common prior assumptions, right? Then Mike should treat John's differing opinion as indicating things that John knows, but that Mike does not. Do you follow what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're both equally, you know, respect each other. And, you know, if your opinion differs, well, it must be because you have a different information set or something. And we need to investigate that is really what a rational actor would do. Mike should realize that they're both capable of mistaking first impressions. Human beings are. And I can go into how that is. You know, we talked a little bit about stage magic and how people make a living manipulating your first impressions. Okay, this is done. It's quite easy to do once you understand the limitations of human perception, vision, all that kind of stuff. If Mike's goal is to predict the truth, okay? He has no good reason to give his own observation greater weight simply because it was his own, assuming that both of you are rational actors and truth seekers. Of course, if Mike is nearsighted while John has 20/20 vision, then Mike might reasonably give less weight to his own observations because he just doesn't see as well. But then John should give Mike's observation less weight as well because he knows he sees better, okay? If they can agree on the relative weight to give their two observations, then they can agree on their estimates regarding what kind of car it was. I mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, John and Mike might be unsure as to who has better eyesight, but this is the kind of a thing that we can test, okay? We can test your eyesight. You can go get your eyes checked and we can figure out who actually sees better and things like that. These are things that we can test using experimental methods. If John and Mike repeated, but not everything is, and this is where I'm going to get into priors and belief systems, because some of these things aren't testable, and this is really where a lot of disagreement is based, and you'll see that. So if John and Mike repeatedly exchange their opinions with each other, their opinions should eventually stop changing, okay, once they've optimized their, in other words, the margin of unsurety, and that's not even a word, is it? The margin of how unsure they are.
Uncertainty or something?
Yeah, uncertainty should become narrower and narrower as they optimize their discussion, you know, about what they saw. Oh, wait a second, you actually do see better than I do. Okay, you have 20/20, but I don't. I saw it in a shadow. It was really fast. You saw it longer because you saw the whole street. You know, those kinds of things. You should finally reach a point where they become mutually aware and have common knowledge of their opinions, and they know why. Okay, and this is what truth seeking is, and you'll find that truth seeking to see that most people who disagree are not actually rational actors. We can see how agreeing to disagree is problematic giving such mutual awareness. Do you follow what I'm getting at? How can you agree to disagree when you're using, when you're acting in good faith, you're both rational actors and you're iterative?
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
Well, yeah, you're right. And again, it's just a way of, you know, sort of peacefully going about our separate ways, I guess, you know. It's not necessarily rational.
It is not.
It's just a way of conflict resolution, essentially.
If you want to know the truth, you have to be rational, and you have to apply the rules, rational rules of logic. Otherwise, you know, what are you doing? Okay, you're just fighting.
Yeah.
Maybe box at each other or something, or spit on each other. I don't know, you know, whatever. Okay, like do whatever. Okay, but you know, when you're in disagreement theory, they talk in generalities. When you're trying to assemble a theory, you try to come up with something that applies across the board. And I'm not going to go too much into detail how that's done, but there are theorists, you know, working on that, and they've pretty much got this nailed down. Let's say we consider the common set of all possible states of the world where John and Mike are mutually aware that John estimates the car to be X while Mike estimates the car to be Y. Do you follow what I'm getting at? This is just all the possibilities here. Or that John estimates that planes were not used and that fake imagery was used, while Mike estimates that planes were used, or that some type of flying object was used, but not fake imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's going to be a lot of different possibilities within that space, right?
Right.
What you're going to find between these two people, if they're not rational, is that no matter what, I'll get into that. What you're going to find. And this basically where I'm going with this talk here is that, you know, should you have a fight with Mike, you have to lay ground rules, and you have to force both parties to apply standards, and they have to be enforced.
Mm-hmm.
You must do that. I'm telling. Otherwise, you might as well just put them on mute and just do your own show. Okay? Yeah, really. I mean, otherwise, this isn't going to help anybody. You know, John and Mike will typically each know many things. Okay. And so we'll know much more than just the fact that the real world is somewhere in that common set, right? In the common set of things I just mentioned, you know, the possible scenarios.
Or explanations.
Regarding the thing, right? If in terms of, you know, just draw a big circle and there's all these possibilities inside the circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know a lot more than that's in that circle that's confined to, you know, the plane issue or something. But they do know. They do each know this fact, and they can each consider counterfactually what their estimate would be if their information were reduced to knowing only one fact. I'm not sure if you're understanding what I'm getting at, but it turns out that the theory of disagreement indicates that people I guess the best way I can explain this is it's kind of dense reading, but the best way I can explain this is I'll just keep going and I'll come back to this. If a theoretical counterfactual John, counterfactual meaning, you know, you're ignoring facts, you know, which you don't do, which is one of the reasons why your show is good, okay? But if theoretically, let's say you were counterfactual and you knew only that, okay, if a theoretical counterfactual John only knew that he was somewhere in this common set, this John would know that he has some good reason to estimate X, whatever that is, even if he does not know exactly what the reason is. So this counterfactual John's estimate should be X. Similarly, if a theoretical counterfactual Mike knew only that he was somewhere in that common set of beliefs, his estimate should be Y. But if counterfactual John and Mike each knew only that the real world is somewhere in this common set of possible worlds, they would each have exactly the same information, and thus each should have the same estimate of the age of the car. If John estimates the car to be 5 years old, then so should Mike, okay? That's just the way it should work. This same argument applies to any dispute about any claim, such as whether a car is a Ford, which is true in some possible worlds and false in others, as long as the disputants can imagine a self-consistent world in which each side is right or wrong and agree on what would be true in that world, okay? Then it should not matter whether the disputed claim is specific or general, hard or easy to verify, about physical objects, politics, or morality, or anything. A more detailed analysis says that people must ultimately agree, but also the discussion path of their alternating expressed opinions must follow a random walk to get there, being iterative. Mike should not be able to tell John how John's next opinion will differ from what Mike just said. Okay? He shouldn't be able to forecast that if they're both rational actors and truth seekers. Yet in real practice, as shown in laboratory experiments, we know that disagreement is still persistent. And the other thing that's weird about it is that two disagreeing parties can often and usually can predict where the other party will go in their disagreement, okay? Which is showing, regardless of facts, which is showing you that this is really just a human problem that, that relate directly to fact patterns. So, for example, you know, if John first says the car's 6 years old and then Mike says the car's 3 years old, a real Mike in the real world and not a theoretical Mike can usually accurately predict that John's next estimate will probably be more than 3 years. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is, for example, as I mentioned earlier, okay, John and Mike, you know, John says that, you know, he doesn't believe the planes were used and Mike does, and But as we explore the facts a little bit further, think about video and whatnot, Mike will probably retreat a little bit and to say that some flying object was used, right? I mean, I can predict that based on position. That isn't fact. That isn't rational. Okay. Am I being clear?
Yeah. I think I get what you're saying here. It's a little bit abstract, but
well, the reason it's abstract is because it comes from disagreement theory, and these things are from papers that are written for an academic audience.
Yeah, exactly.
They're published, you have to. I can talk more in conversational tones about this, but you know, another example. If Mike first says that there were planes, and that John says that there were no planes, John can be expected to accurately predict that Mike's next estimate will probably be that cruise missiles were used rather than planes. Okay? If John is rational, this suggests that Mike is not efficiently using the information contained in John's forecast. Long story short, you know, this was all taken from a bunch of scientific papers and things that I'm trying to, you know, interpret for people, which is not the easiest thing to do, you know, in a radio broadcast. But long story short, what the gist of this is that human disagreement is not rational, okay? And what you need to do is to battle that is use a common rule set and, you know, apprise everybody of what the rules are. So
I see.
That's right. It's very important. Otherwise, further deliberation and discussion only drives the parties further and further apart.
Yeah. See, this is what I wanted to get into also, and this is so true. I mean, I can't tell you how many times in my own personal life it's like you try to get somebody to look into 9/11, and they immediately reject it, or you know, they just won't look into it, or they're just being dishonest about it in general.
Yeah.
And you keep sending them information, or you keep bringing it up, or, you know, you keep trying to get them to look into it, and it works the opposite way. It's just going to alienate them further.
That's right.
Yeah. And so that's the big problem with disagreements. And again, it shows you that it's not rational.
No, they aren't. They typically, the thing is that, okay, here's another little analogy. Okay, John and Mike, you have many internal biases, okay?
But everybody does. Everybody does.
I do. Everybody has internal biases. But as long as you have a rational core, that's okay. So consider, like, let's say a company with many irrational employees, but with a truth-seeking CEO in charge of its official statements, okay? Right? This is, you kind of need to be your own CEO. This CEO should treat inputs from subordinates, who many of which are irrational, as mere data and try to correct for their internal biases, mm-hmm. okay? Do you understand? That's kind of like what you need to do. You need to police yourself in that way is what, where this is going. And both parties need to. Okay, where you have to recognize, listen, you know, I'm human, I've got these, you know, these biases and, you know, sometimes irrationalities, you know, but as long as I have a rational core, that should be okay, and I really am a truth seeker, and I want to know what's up, so I'm not putting my own interest before what's true, you know, that, if you get two people doing that, you're probably going to come up with a good answer, but what, you know, this kind of brings us into what truth seeking is, and,
yeah, how would you characterize genuine truth-seeking?
Well, the beliefs of real people, not theoretical people, usually depend not only on the information about a problem, but also their mental context, such as their style of analysis, their chosen assumptions, their backgrounds, their worldview, and recent thoughts. The existence of these features is not in itself a reason to disagree, though. A truth-seeker who does not know which mental context is the most reliable, okay, depending on the problem, should probably seek out more information rather than less among different mental contexts instead mm-hmm. of simply relying on one random context. So what I'm saying is that Mike should pay attention to John's opinion, not only because it may embody information that Mike does not have, but also because it's the product of a different mental context, and Mike should want to average over as many as he can if he's rational, okay? Mm-hmm. That is what a rational actor will do. You know, and I know, and one of the reasons I like your show, frankly, John, is because I know that you do this. I've seen you do this in many different – it's difficult to do, and I know the mental gymnastics that are necessary to actually place yourself almost at a disadvantage to consider somebody else's viewpoint. And I know that you've done that, and it's helped you find out, you know, sort of like where the truth lies. And it's, you know, you're getting
–
this is what you do. This is one mm-hmm. of the – seems to be the way that you think.
Yeah, I certainly try to. I mean, I'm interested in hearing from all perspectives, all sides of the debate. And I think that's demonstrated in some of the guests I've had and some of the shows I've done since I've been doing radio.
Yeah, it is. You definitely do. And so this kind of brings me to the question of whether or not do people just lie? Is that what they're doing? You know, when you're dealing with somebody and they disagree with you, and they just disagree, and they get further. Why do they do that? Are they just liars? And it turns out, sadly, that...
Oh,
that's what the, yes.
Sorry, you cut out there for just a second. You said, so when people disagree, are they just liars? And then you cut out.
Yeah, it turns out that hypothesis is strongly supported.
Yeah. And guys, just to be clear here, I'm not trying to beat up on Mike by any means. Tom's not trying to beat up on Mike by any means. We're just, you know, using these as examples. But ultimately, I do think you're right. I mean, this is what I was going to say also. When if you're a genuine truth seeker, and I mean, I do consider myself to be a genuine truth seeker, you should be able to admit when you're wrong. And I don't see very many people that are able to do that.
No,
I mean, if I'm wrong about something, I will freely admit it. And in many cases, I have. I have admitted when I've been wrong. And to me, that's what this is all about. It's not about, you know, thinking that you know everything. I don't know everything, and that's why I'm trying to figure out what's really going on in this world and what's really happened in this world. And if I'm wrong about something, I want to openly admit that just to, you know, to get to the truth.
I've seen you do that. That seems to be the way you do business, which is, I find, very admirable. Everyone does not operate to those standards. As I mentioned, do they lie, or are they just dishonest about their opinions? You know, unfortunately, people usually have a strong impression that they themselves are not lying. Okay.
The other person is.
That's right.
Yeah.
And while it's kind of weird. Okay. This is why I'm coming back to this idea of, like, look, you know, you have to have ground rules. Decide what the ground rules are as far as, like, what constitutes a fact, what constitutes logic, and what's allowed. Okay. You can't just be, you know, cherry picking. Okay. This,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to have a quote unquote debate with somebody, the problem with debates is that there's always some element of sport involved in a debate. And I think,
well, there's competition. Yeah.
Yeah. They typically aren't or refereed very well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it might be, you know, entertaining for a person to watch, you know, and look at the different kinds of, you know, the kind of techniques that person A in the debate uses against person B, you know, whether it might be something, you know, might be, you know, personal attacks, ad hominem attacks, or a straw man, or, for example, last night, I'm not going to mention the guy's name, or somebody who's written something that is highly contrary to facts, and what they've done is they've relied on using the straw man approach, where they misrepresent our position regarding what we're saying about Sandy Hook.
Yeah, okay. I see this all the time on the internet.
Absolutely. So
yeah.
It builds up, and they're saying that we're making these broad brush statements about everything, and then they knock down the straw man. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's not what we're saying. We're actually looking at specific fact patterns, and we're showing our work. So the corollary to that is, let's say I'm doing a math problem, I'm doing a math problem, and I'm actually letting you see my work, how
yeah.
I got there.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not saying, you know, this is 7.3, you know, because I say so because I'm, you know, investing it or something. No, you know, and this, the other thing that I wanted to mention regarding all this stuff is worldview. Okay.
Yeah.
And how this is a component to the positioning of a person in a debate or in a disagreement scenario. You know, if you both have the worldview, the same worldview, it's unlikely that your worldviews are going to contribute to your disagreement. Okay. But if you have two different worldviews that are fundamentally incompatible, then that is going to be yet another problem that needs to be overcome, you know, in dealing with truth seeking.
Yeah.
Am I clear?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Okay. This is
a
basic fact. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean, you know, in my experience, you know, trying to sort of get somebody to look into 9/11 when they have a totally contrary worldview to me, it's impossible.
Let's say that they're a you know, a usurping dual citizen scumbag who has found it profitable financially.
Okay, can you guys hear me again? Can you guys in the chat room hear me?
Supposed to drop it.
Yeah, man. I don't know what the hell is going on. Can you guys in the chat room hear me? Hold on. I think we're back. You know what? This is getting really, really irritating. My Skype just totally drops me. And it like...
We'll fix it.
Yeah, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, we'll fix it.
Yeah, we can. Everybody should be able to hear us now. Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess I thought with Worldview or something, right?
Yeah. You were talking about Worldview. Yeah. Go ahead.
Let me just pick it up. You know, a lot of our people recognize that we've got an identity problem. That white people in the United States have an identity problem, and what that's tied to is worldview. Everybody's identity and place in the world is tied to their worldview. We know that Jewish Bolsheviks have systematically attacked our worldview by injecting false narratives. These are just facts. The role of the narrative is to provide a foundation for your thinking about who you are and your role in the world. That's what a narrative does, and that's how they, you know, a bunch of narratives kind of form the basis of the worldview, which form the lens through which you see the world. So that's how the human brain works. The 9/11 narrative has set the stage, okay, for certain things. The Holocaust narrative has set the stage for certain things. The slavery narrative has set the stage for certain things, and it seems to, you know, to be having a negative effect on our people. Even our children have been developing negative attitudes about self, about their ancestors, due to this, you know, this guilt strategy that we talked about, which is intentional, by the way. I think, in my opinion, it's an evil form of warfare, and I would call attacking somebody's basis of beliefs as total war, in every sense of the word. Okay, the road to recovery is reconstruction of our worldview. Okay, this is where the identity problem does lie. The enemy knows that, which is why they try to undermine this. Okay, we can actually, I think we can solve the problem pretty quickly. You know, we have to reinvent the wheel. There's lots of writings on this that help to understand sort of where we really do fit in the world. I know that your interviews with certain guests lately are really helpful in that regard. But basically, a worldview is a set of assumptions about the physical and social reality that shapes the way we perceive we perceive and interpret our world. A worldview also provides a sense of meaning to reality and guides the inferences a person draws from our experiences. These core constructs or assumptions form the foundation for knowing and understanding and guiding cognition and behavior. So be considered third-order constructs that are distinct from lower-order constructs, such as mere attitudes. Worldviews are deeper than that. And, you know, we need to be thinking in terms of, you know, if you have a kid or something, you know, you really
Tom, you want to
help bolster and solidify in ways that... Okay, I'll slow down again.
Yeah, sorry, you're starting
to
cut out a little bit.
Let me know if I'm still audible or not.
You know, you are. It just kind of glitches up. So you're saying to protect your kids. I heard you say something about that.
Absolutely, and yourself. Yeah. I think a lot of we also need to do a little study. And there's some things. I've got a lot of materials and places we can point people to take a look into what other people have thought about with worldview and you know where to go with that. But the history behind this whole concept of worldview pretty much started apparently with this guy called Immanuel Kant. Who was he had this, you know, the concept of worldview in German. There's a German word. I'm not going to try to pronounce it. I might botch it or whatever. But
the Weltanschauung or whatever.
Exactly. And basically, it's translated in German into English as philosophy of life. The term describes a general perspective that makes sense of the world. Okay. And there's this other guy named Hegel, who thought that a given worldview inherently competes against others to be the most accurate and all-encompassing. So basically what Hegel is saying is that the human condition involves each group having a worldview. And he said that Hegel said that essentially populations with different worldviews will necessarily be in conflict due to the incompatibility of the systems. Mm-hmm. Very important. And it turns out that there's also, that worldview influences can also be genetically influenced, which is really sort of more, you know, I'm arguing more for the whole concept of living space for your own people, regardless of who you are, you know, so that you can have self-determination, right?
If yeah.
you look, you're going to have one worldview that's going to compete with your worldview, and now we're in a fight, and, you know, it's just not cool, okay? That's basically, we've all seen this, and we have this.
And it's so bad because most people don't even realize that there is a struggle over worldviews going on.
But if they understand that, then they can understand what the basis is, okay? And this goes back to this whole thing about disagreement, too, and where worldview fits into, why people disagree even regardless of the same facts, okay, which is crazy. It's crazy, but that's the way humans are. A guy named Wittgenstein posited that a world picture, you know, kind of like he called it world picture, is learned in childhood and serves as a framework for a person's thoughts, values, and actions. And this other guy named Naugle, N-A-U-G-L-E, said that the interpretation of human activity in words, okay, form the foundation of a person's experience and understanding as they embody and express the fundamental features and categories of the world, which, you know, basically what he was saying is that that language itself is a very powerful thing that the brain needs, you know, and this brings me back to the NLP sort of attacks that we've been getting where this certain group of usurpers, these dual citizens, they use language as a weapon. So they, you know, they'll refer to certain groups as underprivileged using charged words. They always use words that seem to attack whites, and they do this on purpose. Okay, like, you know, even calling, it's done on purpose. I can do the same thing back at them, no problem. I won't even bother at the moment, but just to say that language and word choice is very important. It's actually it affects the brain more than you would think.
Yeah.
Okay. It turns out also worldview, you know, it's not really something that as a kid, you know, you don't choose it. You don't say, well, gee, I really wonder if this is the right way to view the world. Well, it turns out that you pretty much inherit your worldview from your parents and the people that your parents allow you to come in contact with. It's not something that you choose, but later on in life, if you're a truth seeker, you might actually find yourself in a position where you wind up in crisis, like for example, like I did. Okay, I used to think certain things about the way the world was. I used to think that, you know, World War II was righteous and all this stuff. Well, come to find out, the facts have pointed in a different direction, and it caused me to have to really kind of reconsider how I view things. And,
exactly. Me too.
That's right. And that caused me pain, I'd say, for a certain period of time. But the cool thing about it was that I know that I'm closer to the truth now. I know that that certain things, I know what a fact is. I know how to find a fact, and I'm getting a much clearer picture of reality. I'm much more comfortable with reality rather than just a bunch of BS.
Exactly.
The funny thing about world picture or world view is it's not necessarily rational. I want mine to be rational. I know that John wants his to be rational, which is kind of like why we're on the same page here, because we're using rational thought. We're also using logic to find truth. And that's really what I want my worldview to reflect, not just something that's good for me or good for the Jews or good for whatever group. You know, no, I want to know what's true. And that might be just sort of a characteristic of our genetics to want this rather than just simply be biased based on our group affiliation. I don't know, you know, but that's... that's kind of like where I'm coming from. I know that that's where a lot of these well-meaning people are coming from. They want to know what's true.
Yeah.
In the end, I think that that's really where we need to go. You know, again, a world picture is not necessarily rational. It's not even necessary for it to be thoroughly internally consistent. As we know, you know, when you talk about religion, for example, certain aspects of certain religious teachings are not, in fact, internally consistent. But they do make up a person's worldview, or they tend to, you know, be a really serious, important underpinning for many people.
Yeah.
The reason why this works, it has to do with the way the brain works. There's only so much gray matter there. You need to instantly deal with situations as they arise as you're walking down the street. You have to have a context within which to put things, okay? If you're walking in through the woods and you see like a squiggly line moving,